The Business of Biotech is produced by Life Science Connect and its community of learning, solving, and sourcing resources for biopharma decision makers. If you're working on biologics process development and manufacturing challenges, you need to swing by bioprocessonline.com. If you're trying to stay ahead of the cell or gene therapy curve, visit cellandgene.com. When it's time to map out your clinical course, let clinicalleader.com help. And if optimizing outsourcing decisions is what you're after, check out outsourcepharma.com. We're Life Science Connect, and we're here to help. I try not to play favorites, but within minutes of our conversation starting, Dr. Gavin Samuels became one of my favorite guests on The Business of Biotech. Gavin, an MD, was an intensive care physician before he joined industry. Hard to wrap my mind around, but he joined industry because he got bored doing that. Bored running an intensive care unit. Can you imagine? I'm Matt Piller. This is The Business of Biotech, and I had the absolute pleasure to learn about and learn from Dr. Samuels, who's now Chief Business Officer at SynRx, when we sat down in San Francisco to record this episode. Beyond his fascinating career journey, we discussed deal-making in a tumultuous market, the unique buyer-seller position that SynRx finds itself in, what healthy tension between drug development and business development looks like, what a responsible obesity therapeutic looks like, and a whole lot more. It's a good one. Let's give it a listen.
And I learned that before you joined SynRx.
SynRx.
In 2022, you were Lonza's head of strategy and growth initiatives. You've held major roles, obviously, there, Pfizer, a host of other smaller biotechs. What led you, I guess, sort of a two-part question, what led you away from big bio, and how did you land at SynRx?
Well, I think one way of explaining it is a little bit like the Little Red Riding Hood story. Mm-hmm. The one bed was too big, the other one was too small, and the third one was just right.
Okay.
Big Pharma was an excellent place to learn the industry. And I was at Pfizer and then at Teva. And if you want to learn how to do drug development, those are great places. Both of them are great places to learn it. But they're massive organizations, which means the bureaucracy and the process is challenging. Everything takes a long time in these big teams. And innovation is difficult in big organizations. So, you know, that was one component of my career education, if you like. And then there's a lot to be learned by a very small, nimble biotech as well, mm-hmm. where decision making is very quick. And things have to run according to a shoestring budget often. And one can learn where you can trim down on certain aspects. The challenge in a small biotech company is there's never enough money. So trimming becomes, you know, too much sometimes. And you start cutting corners mm-hmm. where corners shouldn't be cut. And I think SynRx is the right size institution. It's got a lot of what Big Pharma has to offer, meaning everything is done properly. Mm-hmm. There's no corners cut. But at the same time, you have the rapid decision-making and the innovation, which allows for a very efficient and effective drug development process. It's kind of the best of both worlds, which is where I personally feel most comfortable.
Yeah.
And where I can feel from a personality and an experience perspective, I'm able to make the most contribution in that size organization.
Yeah, that was the next follow-up question I had for you on that was like, what do you think it is that's different about someone who, you know, it's not an uncommon refrain, right, to start in big bio and then to move to a smaller biotech.
Yeah.
And like you said, you found sort of a happy medium. But, you know, a lot of people land at a place like Pfizer or Teva or Lonza and they stay there for their entire career. They can. What do you think it ticks differently within someone who says, you know what, I want to take the risk of agility in a leadership position?
So I think it comes down to a large extent to one's personality, which in turn informs on one's risk tolerance. Mm-hmm. Certainly when I was at Pfizer, there was the possibility of a very long career trajectory. That was not very stressful at all and very comfortable in terms of resources and large teams where everyone had their area of expertise. But I've always been someone who enjoys a challenge and enjoys learning something new. And I'm very comfortable when I don't exactly know how I'm supposed to do the thing, the task that's in front of me, and to you kind of stretching myself to figure out a solution. So it's not so common in a big pharma company to do that.
Yeah.
So I think the single most important factor in determining what the right size organization is for a person is their own personality, their level of risk tolerance, their desire to make a difference. It's difficult to make a difference in a big, clunky organization. It's much easier to make a difference in an agile, rapidly evolving, rapidly growing organization.
When you say make a difference, you mean like a personal contribution that you can sort of feel and measure toward the solution?
It manifests on various levels. At the end of the day, I went into healthcare because I'm passionate about wanting to make a difference in people's lives, meaning to improve quality of life, whether that means the ability to cure disease or at least improve the quality of someone's disease burden. That's the primary focus. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning and most of my colleagues at SynRx. So one can achieve that much more tangibly in a small organization than in a big organization. Right. And then also, when you one of many people working on a project, let's say a transaction, for example, when you're one of many people working on it, it's not that easy to really feel that what you're doing has a direct correlation with whether the deal is successful or not. Whereas in a small organization, it's all on you. And either you make it happen or you don't. So I enjoy the challenge, the pressure, and the challenge and eventually, you know, the success of knowing that these two hands actually made a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, rewinding even further, you, and it's sort of, I guess pulling the same thread, right. Of the decisions you made along your career trajectory. You earned your MD and you were a clinician, right? You practiced medicine?
I did practice medicine. I was working in intensive care. And I practiced for 8 years. The reason that I decided to change would probably surprise most people. I got bored with clinical medicine, and I got bored with a particular branch of clinical medicine, which is intensive care.
It doesn't seem like that would, like, to a layman like me, that doesn't seem like it would be boring at all.
You're right. So it seems difficult to understand how that could be boring. But if you understand how intensive care works, it's all algorithm based. So you have a particular patient and they have a particular set of symptoms or a particular presentation, and you fall back on an algorithm. You do this test. If it shows this, you do this. And if it's yes, you follow this part. And if it's no, you follow this part. And eventually, after a number of years, that algorithm becomes internalized. Mm. And it's a bit like driving a car. You're not actually thinking that much. It's kind of automatic. And what I found frustrating about that is that I felt like I was not thinking. There's certainly no creativity in the intensive care unit. It's all following an algorithm. And I felt like I wasn't using my brain. And it happens to be that my wife was doing an MBA at the time, and she said, why don't you do a few subjects just for fun? And I did. And it was amazing because it was a completely different way of thinking to medical science. It was almost the opposite. In medical science, you take a whole lot of data and you try and funnel it down into a diagnosis. In business studies, you're almost doing the opposite. You take an idea and try and expand it out into something. What I really enjoy is the combination, mm-hmm. the medical science with the business component of it.
Yeah. So when you joined industry, you did so with because this was another, I guess, transitionary question in my mind. Again, it's not uncommon for people who practice medicine, for doctors to join industry. often in chief scientific or chief medical officer roles. The chief business officer role is maybe less common for a clinician to get into. So when you made the decision to take some to join industry, you did so like fully intending to learn the business side and go into that side, or were you in more of a scientific role? Or
like— I started off in a more scientific role, and then kind of moved into the intersection between clinical development and commercialization, meaning how do you set up a clinical trial that meets the endpoints that could also justify various regulatory indications that support the commercial aspects of a drug development. And then from that, there was kind of a natural progression to move more to the transaction side. And once I moved into the transaction side, I knew I'd landed. This is where I wanted to be, because the substrate of the transaction is still a drug, or often an early stage drug, which relies on a good understanding of the science, the medical science, which I enjoy, but also understanding risk and uncertainty over time in drug development, and then constructing a transaction that is appropriate for both sides of that transaction, given the risk and uncertainty over time. And if you can crack that, that results in a transaction that's useful for both parties and ultimately can benefit the patients and treating physicians as well.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm going to ask you a theoretical or philosophical question about this, because I'm thinking about it like corollary, in simple terms. I'm thinking about this in sort of a corollary fashion to the business that I'm in. Yeah. I'm in media, and I've been for my entire career. So we create content, all sorts of different content. We have a BD team, obviously, a business development team, sales team. I've learned over the course of my career to become very discerning about when and how I make our BD folks aware of a new product, because BD folks want to sell it before it's ready, right? So if we think about that in terms of biopharmaceuticals, there's got to be at least some inherent friction. Yet you, with your background, you come sort of to the apex of those two disciplines, understanding both. Does that benefit you? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Like, I do.
Does it benefit you? And at times, does it create, you know, even a hint of conflict or friction with other BD folks who want to move?
It can create some...
I hope, by the way, that none of my BD folks are listening to this episode.
It can create some conflict. I prefer to think of it as creating a good tension that finds the right balance between where a drug is in its development, what the risks and uncertainty are that are associated with that drug between today and when it eventually gets to the market, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And then finding a transaction between the two parties that balances and shares the risk over time. Because when a transaction is signed and the ink is dried, that's not the end. That's the beginning of the relationship often. And there's a long path that needs to be traveled together. So if you've set up the transaction in a collaborative way and the entire negotiation has taken place, not in a confrontational mode, but rather in a collaborative mode, that sets the stage for the long-term relationship. That's good, not only for both parties, but optimizes the probability of a successful drug at the end of the day. Yeah. It's a win-win-win-win situation.
When, if ever, does the... Yeah, I get that. I have a lot of conversations with chief business officers in biotech. And, you know, collaboration comes up often in negotiation. And I get the sense that, you know, that's the ideal. But I'm curious about if you'd be willing to share when... There does when conflict does appear or arise, even slight conflict.
Yes.
What is it usually centered on?
It often comes about because of certain issues, and there's usually more than one. There's usually a handful of issues that arise where people tend to be fixed in their position. Mm. And not willing to move. And a suboptimal way of dealing with that situation is to simply compromise. So, you know, the simplest is around an economic parameter. I want to offer you $100. You will only receive $200. We compromise at $150, and that's, you know, halfway. Neither of us are particularly happy, and neither of us are particularly unhappy. That's suboptimal. Mm-hmm. A much better approach to compromise is to say, not why are you insisting on 200, not that you are insisting on $200, but why? What is it about the $200? What is it about your position that's important? Is it really just about the $200, or is there something else that gives us more substrate to be able to work with? So instead of compromising, you come up with a creative solution that results in both parties being happy instead of just both parties not being unhappy.
I can see why algorithms would bore you. Because there's no algorithm for you.
There's no algorithm for that. Yeah.
Another interesting challenge that you must face as CBO at SynRx is the diversity. I'm assuming it's a challenge. I'll ask for your perspective on that. But the diversity of the portfolio of candidates and indications that you pursue. You know, there are companies that are very narrow in focus on a specific molecule or a specific indication, maybe multiple molecules for that specific indication. SynRx is not that. So what sort of challenges does that present to you as chief business officer? And I imagine I'm going to project here a little bit. I'm assuming that your scientific and medical backgrounds lend to your ability to transact and do business. Yeah. Across multiple products, but it's got to create some challenge.
It is. We're not focused in one particular therapeutic area. We have several therapeutic areas. We're not agnostic, meaning we won't take on anything that comes our way, even if it is a program that's attractive. In order for us to consider a program, it has to be matched to capabilities and experience within the organization. Mm-hmm. We have an advantage in that we have a strategic alliance with a very large CRO called MedPace, which spans a number of therapeutic areas. So we're able to tap into deep expertise in a number of different therapeutic areas. Even if we don't have a medical director in a specific disease area, we're able to tap in often to medical people who do have expertise in that area. And we go to a lot of trouble and a lot of effort to forming good scientific advisory boards with the best and brightest minds in that particular disease area. So it's not agnostic, but it's not overly narrow either. And we find a balance between the right number of therapeutic areas to work in without spreading ourselves too thin, but always ensuring that we have, either through internal people or through the ability to hire consultants or through the ability of very strong scientific advisory boards, and lastly, through our relationship with MedPace, to have absolutely rock solid, cutting edge, world-class expertise on a particular program.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to the mid, you know, your comfort level with sort of a mid-range company.
Yes.
Being SynRx, the company demonstrates that. So like when I think about it in very simple terms, you know, there's buy side, there's sell side.
Yeah.
And biotech typically is, you know, we want to sell something, whether it's us or a product or a platform. And then there's, you know, big bio that's on the buy side. They want to buy them or their product or their platform. SynRx is on both sides of this coin, right?
Right.
I mean, you've demonstrated that recently with transactions where you're both buying and selling. I think a couple I noted here were your investment in VTV. You also negotiated multi-billion dollar deals like the sale of Syncor to AstraZeneca. So like, you know, it's exemplary of being on both sides of that coin. In your role as chief business officer there, what have you had to learn? What challenges have you confronted to be able to kind of recognize good strategic deals on both sides of that equation.
Your question is excellent, and it speaks to our particular model. What we typically do is we bring in early stage compounds. So that's late preclinical or early clinical stage compounds. And then we nurture them for a period of time, usually until phase two or midway through phase two, and then we exit. So we've got a particular area, if you'd like to think of it as adolescence, where we take it. So we bring in a toddler, we give them a very loving home for a period of years, and then we allow them to go out into the big wide world. And the strategic transactions occur at bringing in the asset at the early stage through a licensing agreement or an acquisition. That's the usual way that we do that. And then we develop the program up to a predetermined inflection point. We have no intention of commercializing the drug. So we don't take the program through to phase three and into commercialization. We're not set up for that. We don't have the expertise for that. The big pharma companies are much better suited to that. So once we have usually human proof of concept somewhere in phase two, then we start looking at either the company being acquired or licensed to a big pharma company or going an IPO route, which is what happened with Synport. It became a completely independent company through an IPO. And then as an independent public company, did the transaction with AstraZeneca. I'd love to take credit for that transaction, but I wasn't involved at all because it was a completely independent public company by that stage.
Yeah. Okay. You had mentioned earlier that you're not agnostic. Synrx is not agnostic. So I want to dig a little bit into the selection criteria, right? So like recently, you've illustrated interest in metabolic disease, right? So you've got four early phase mono and combination therapies for the treatment of obesity in the pipeline. And not coincidentally, you've built your scientific advisory board with quite a bit of metabolic expertise.
Yes.
In recent years or months. So that's an indicator, you know, that there's a hot area for you. When and how, like using that maybe as an example, like when and how does that become a focus area for Synrx?
So the general focus areas where we have deep expertise within the company is cardiovascular, metabolic, and renal disease. Those are that's the main, the core where our expertise lies. Mm-hmm. And it's to some extent a common thread flowing through those areas. Metabolic disease leads to cardiovascular disease and renal disease. So there's, you know, it's different facets of an overall, you know, bad Western diet, growing obesity levels, that plagues our society. And metabolic disease is the kind of linchpin that holds many of these disease areas together and is the initiating pathology that leads on to cardiovascular and eventually renal disease as well. So it's an area of deep interest for us. Until recently, the treatment of obesity has been very poor, just there haven't been effective and safe drugs. And that has, of course, in the last several years, been completely revolutionized with the advent of the GLP-1 drugs.
Yeah. Was Synrx focused there before this sort of GLP craze took off?
There was interest always in obesity and diabetes, which is kind of the sister disease of obesity. Mm-hmm. But once the obesity area, this brave new world where obesity is a disease that can be medically treated very safely and very effectively, then it certainly was kicked up a few notches.
Yeah. How do, I guess, waves of innovation in a disease area affect a company like Synrx in terms of its pipeline and perhaps influencing
right
where you focus? Like, I'm not insinuating that the GLP craze is, I mean, you know, when COVID came about, everybody was developing a COVID something, right? For various reasons.
Yeah.
Perhaps because there was something to be treated, perhaps because there was a lot of money available to go treat that. So I guess I'm just getting, wondering, like, in a position like yours, where you have a direct influence on what comes in and what goes out, how much market forces and factors sort of influence you or sway you in different directions?
I said earlier that what gets not only me, but most of the people at the company out of bed in the morning is you know, thinking of the patient. Mm-hmm. And in the context of obesity, where you know this miracle drug or category of drugs is now available, what we try and do is say, this is fantastic. We've got you know, a disease area that is now very treatable. What's next? Where can this area be improved? What are the shortfalls in the current disease, in the current treatment options? And where is it going? So to illustrate with obesity, the GLP-1 drugs are fantastic, but they have several problems. One, when you start taking the drug, people put the weight right back on. Mm. About 60% of the weight comes back in the first year. And then often people will overshoot where they started off. So they'll land up, if they stop taking the drug, in a more obese state than before they started taking the drug.
Yeah.
Second issue is tolerability. The drugs have in not everyone, but in a lot of people, they have tolerability issue, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And some people cannot tolerate those effects. So titrating up in the dose, starting on a small dose and working up slowly is one way of dealing with it. But a percentage of people will not be able to tolerate those drugs. And lastly, when one loses weight, there's bad weight, which is adipose tissue, which is fat. But there's also muscle and bone mass, which is lost as well. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're 20 or 30, that's not terrible. But if you 50 and 60, losing muscle mass or lean body mass.
You're accelerating something that's already happening.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's a problem. So what we do when we sit around at SynRx and talk about obesity for the future, the discussion goes, what are the alternative approaches that we can take to obesity? How might obesity treatment, similar to hypertension or cancer treatment, it's not one drug, it's a combination of drugs to manage tolerability issues. How might that evolve? How can we look at focusing on weight loss that is predominantly adipose tissue, fat weight loss, while preserving lean body mass? And there are various approaches to that. So the patient is the starting point. The science is the pathway. And then we scour the earth looking for approaches that make sense, that could meet those scientific objectives that we've set, looking back at the patient of the future and how treatment might be optimized for him or her.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a bit of an update on where SynRx is in terms of clinical activity right now?
Sure. Okay. On the metabolic front specifically?
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Since we're talking about that, but, and, you know, feel free to discuss any notable clinical activity.
So the portfolio company that the metabolic drugs are housed in is called Synfema. And the four drugs that we have there is two novel mechanisms. The one is called GDF15 and the other one is PYY. They're alternative approaches to treating obesity to the GLP-1s. They work in a different way. Mm-hmm. And then we're looking at the possibility of combining those two drugs, each with a GLP-1 analog. The idea behind it being, can you improve tolerability for patients? And can you maintain lean body mass while reducing the bad fat, the adipose tissue?
Yeah.
And that's the focus of our ongoing clinical study.
That's interesting, because another question that was swimming around in the back of my mind while we were talking about GLP-1 and your approach to obesity is sort of the displacement of new approach, you know, the displacement of old approaches to even, you know, non-therapeutic approaches to a specific indication by new indications. For instance, before GLP-1, gastric bypass was the trend, a surgical intervention,
right?
Which comes with perhaps maybe less risk of losing lean body weight and bone density. But similarly, I'm not sure what the word for it is, but when you fall off the wagon, you fall hard, right? Even with gastric bypass.
Right.
So like with new technologies that perhaps address some of those shortcomings, perhaps you can displace the previous approach, the previous standard, but you're saying that's not necessarily the approach that Cinerex is taking.
Well, indeed it is, because one of the drugs that we're working on, the GDF-15, may well, and this is something we interrogating in the clinical trials, in the development of the clinical trials, could a drug like GDF-15 be the maintenance part of the patient's therapy? So the GLP-1s are excellent at dropping weight significantly and quickly. But if the GLP-1s are continuing to cause one to lose lean body mass, that's not a great idea in the very long term. Yeah. So might a drug like GDF-15, which may not have the lean body mass loss, in fact, there are some data that suggest it improves lean body mass. So might that be an appropriate strategy for once a person has lost the weight enough to improve their health outcomes significantly, but then doesn't necessarily want to stop and put the weight right back on, but doesn't necessarily want to be on a GLP-1 for the rest of their life either? Might a drug like the GDF-15 be the maintenance therapy part of the patient?
Should that work? It plays beautifully, it seems, to the adolescence analogy that you gave me earlier, right? Like there should be an ample opportunity to market that to big bio.
So it's early days. We understanding how these drugs work and what the effects are on lean body mass and adipose tissue. But it's very exciting because the armamentarium that will be available to treat obesity is just exponential, and many, many therapies will be available and would be able to be tailored to exactly what a particular patient needs.
Yeah. Any other notable clinical progress of late in other?
We have two gastrointestinal companies. We're working on a disease area called gastroparesis, which is a disease that can either be idiopathic, just happens for no apparent reason, or is very commonly associated with patients who have diabetes, and that's a bloating, an inability of the stomach contents to move. It causes pain and nausea and vomiting and can be very debilitating. And we're working on a drug that's currently in phase two on that. We have another program that's for irritable bowel syndrome, the diarrheal form. Irritable bowel syndrome is by far the most common reason for referral to a gastroenterologist. A very high number of people suffer from that, and there's certainly significant improvements that need to be made in the treatments that are available. Mm. We have an early stage oncology program. And we also have, as you said, BTB, which is another metabolic company. That's an investment that we made. Yeah. So a number of different areas, and we're constantly looking for new, interesting opportunities. JP Morgan is a great place to catch up with people, progress transactions that are in the making.
Yeah, when you come into an engagement like JP Morgan or any investor conference for that matter, this being sort of the granddaddy of them all, but
right.
When you personally come into an event like this, again, similar to the challenges that you have as a company who's transacting on both ends of the spectrum, how do you sort of, what's your MO? How do you sort of come into this event like with a mindset that you've got goals to achieve when, I mean, really, it can move in any number of directions for your company?
There's three big things that we're doing all the time. We're looking for new opportunities. We're raising money to feed the hungry children through their adolescent parents.
Someone must have coached you and said, listen, when you go talk to Matt, he likes really simple analogies. that's a good one.
That's the way my brain works. Very, very simple analogies. And then, the exit, be it an IPO or a strategic transaction with a big pharma company. So any one of these partnering conferences, we're generally doing all three. We're meeting with potential investors, and investments can happen at the TopCo area at the SynRx level, or investments in the various portfolio companies at the appropriate time. And constantly looking for in-licensing opportunities and constantly talking to big pharma companies about potential strategic investments, or talking to bankers about IPO, if such things ever come back to us. But always doing those three things at every conference.
Yeah. So you mentioned IPOs. From what I understand, in late Q4 23, the M&A market started to pick up again. Interest rates are coming down. You know, there's a reason for optimism, and I'm feeling it. It's hard not to feel it at this event. Yeah. Like, you can come into a bear market, and no offense, but the chief business officers of the world come in with their best foot forward and smiles on their faces, and everything's sunshine and roses. The sense here, though, is that there are some real indicators that things are turning around. What's your take?
I do think that we've turned a corner. The last half of 23 was absolutely brutal for all three of those areas that we work in. It was very difficult. There seems to be, in addition to the hard indicators that you mentioned, the interest rates and the number of transactions improving, there is an air of optimism, and the conversations are a little freer. And at the end of the day, there is money. People have been reluctant and cautious to part with their money in the form of investments, particularly the last half of 23, but can't hold on to money forever. So with interest rates, with the softer and harder indicators of gradual improvement, it feels better, even this early on in this year.
Yeah, and sentiment creates inertia.
Exactly.
So, it sounds like sort of a soft or fluffy to say, well, it feels better, but there is truth to it. Like, feeling the sentiment does move the needle.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, excellent. So I often like to ask seasoned veterans of the space to share advice with perhaps first-time founders and leaders of biotechs. I'd like to kind of winnow that question down for you a little bit, based on your experiences and your past. So if you're speaking to someone who perhaps is coming from the scientific or medical side and has an interest in getting involved in the business side of biotech, speaking specifically to that person, what advice would you offer?
I would say that the transactional side of pharma and biotech is to a large extent an apprentice type education. Mm. So while it's very useful to have formal education in the form of an MBA or whatever you decide to do, that definitely is useful. But the only way of really learning it is to sit at the table and observe and gradually increase your participation. So find someone who you really respect. And respect in this context, I think, has two components. One, that the person genuinely has the patient as the center of their focus. And that's for two reasons. One, we're not selling widgets in this industry. We actually have people's health that they're entrusting to us. And it's a very important and heavy burden to bear that comes with a lot of responsibility. But there's also a good business reason to have the patient at the center, because if you do that and develop your drugs to specifically help patients, either in terms of their disease burden or the quality of their life, the financial reward comes automatically as a part of that.
Do you think that gets lost at times?
I think it does.
Yeah,
I think it does, because particularly in a year like 23, where money is so tight, that the focus drifts away from that to budgets and cutting, you know, cutting corners and trying to save money and do things quicker, and perhaps cutting a few corners that should not be cut. So yes, I think that the focus is lost when times are tough. And then the other is to find someone who transacts in a collaborative way. And there's two reasons for that. One, the end product, the transaction is a much better transaction for all parties involved. And secondly, it's not a particularly pleasant life to spend your entire workday fighting with people. It's much better. It's much more fun, and it's much more pleasurable to spend your time working together with the party on the other side of the table to find a truly innovative, collaborative solution to a problem rather than just slogging out a compromise.
Mm-hmm. The most recent conversation that I had with a chief business officer on this topic, on negotiation, on transacting, was Neela Patel. And it strikes me that she's also an MD,
yes.
Not maybe a PhD, but she came from the science side.
Right.
And you have a similar demeanor. Like you're both very even keeled. You both come across as very intelligent, but, thoughtful. Do you think that's key? Like from a personality standpoint, coming into a position like yours,
I think being even keeled and not not having an ego is helpful because everything takes so long in drug development. It's a 10, 15, 20 year process. And if the person's going to get all flustered and irate and throw temper tantrums.
Emotion.
Yeah. It just doesn't work. You have to be able to just take a step back, really turn off your own ego and look at the process, look at the data in a very critical way, see what makes sense and just work at it. There's, I think of every transaction as having 20 demons to slay. There's 20 problems that come your way on every transaction. Each one of them could derail the transaction completely. And you have to very systematically and very patiently deal with each one, find a solution, and then move on to the next one. And you get to a point 15 demons in where you're over the hump. You know that the deal is going to happen, but there's still the last remaining issues that need to be solved.
Yeah. What Evan, I asked you, Dr. Samuels, that I should have, right? If I were a better interviewer, what would I have asked you? What would you have shared? What would I have pried for that you'd like to add to the conversation?
I think what I am particularly proud of about Synrx is the model, the notion of having a holding company, the Synrx company, with the portfolio company, six at present underneath that. What I like about that is there's tremendous inefficiency in the biotech and pharma space, where a typical small biotech company has a full-time CEO and a full-time CFO and a full-time CMO and CSO and the whole C-suite. And they're working on one particular drug, and it always puzzles us what many of these people are doing for 8 or 10 hours a day. The Synrx model is different. It's about fractionally providing services to the portfolio company. So one portfolio company may need my full attention this week, mm-hmm. For 5 days, 10 hours a day. But next week may not need any of my attention, and I can move on to another company. The same with the CEO services that are provided, the same with the medical services and the scientific services. So what I like about the Synrx model is the efficiency, because people who work in biotech are generally expensive people. They have many, sure. many years of education and experience behind them. And if you can efficiently use those resources across multiple portfolio companies to make sure that every minute of every person's time is being used in an effective and efficient way, I think that's not only good for SynRx, but it's good for drug development because it improves the efficiency and consequently the cost of developing drugs.
Yeah, I mean, so theoretically, totally get it. But in practice, it occurs to me that it would take a special person to be a fractional CMO or CSO or CBO for that matter, across multiple companies, multiple modalities, multiple indications. So I'm not challenging the notion. I'm suggesting that perhaps SynRx has found some unicorns to fill those positions. You know, a lot of folks come at it like, well, I'm an antibody guy. Like, yeah. I can transact all day long in the world of monoclonal antibodies. So tell me a little bit about that.
I don't think it's as rare as unicorns, but I don't think it's for everyone either. Mm-hmm. It's somewhere between. There's a particular personality at SynRx. One anecdote. Every one of us will be on a conference call 2 minutes early. It's a thing.
You were in my makeshift recording booth before I was, so you proved that.
So that's it's a little anecdote, but every single person is 1 or 2 minutes early to every single meeting. We all are very passionate people. We want to make a difference, and we all enjoy tremendous diversity. We get bored doing the same thing every day. So, you know, those are some of the characteristics that a person needs. Again, not a unicorn, but certainly not for everyone either.
Yeah. Okay. So take note. Well, awesome. I appreciate this. You've been a joy to talk with. It's been a very insightful conversation. I'm glad you made some time for me. I know it's a very busy week. So I'm honored that you took some time to spend with the Business of Biotech.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Samuel.
I'm Matt Piller, and you just listened to the Business of Biotech, the weekly podcast dedicated to the builders of biotech. We drop a new episode with a new exec every Monday morning. And I'd like you to join our community of subscribers at bioprocessonline.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our never spammy, always insightful monthly newsletter at bioprocessonline.com/BOB. If you have feedback or topic and guest suggestions, hit me up on LinkedIn and let's chat. And as always, thanks for listening.